from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. It's fair to say that Illinois Congresswoman Nikki Budzinski has served in the U.S. House during a fraught time. Republicans have had a hard time getting along with each other, let alone passing bipartisan legislation. But on the latest episode of Politically Speaking, the Springfield Democrat explains why she's been able to cut through the political noise and also makes a case for a second term. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, an in-depth examination of Missouri and Illinois politics.
The instant we got to Illinois, we joined the Green Party. This was 2000.
So I've tried to push for those that I think are honest and really care about the future of the city.
You know, this wasn't a path that I thought I would choose in 2012 when I was able to win the closest Republican victory in the nation.
If it's something that will help Southern Illinois, I'll work with them on it. If there's something he's doing wrong, then you got to fight him on it.
I believe very strongly in the Second Amendment. I believe less government is better, and I believe local control is better.
I choose to fight for working families and for union members.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining us in studio today, he covers all things Metro East.
Will Bauer.
For St. Louis Public Radio. You're so excited to be a co-host.
I cut you off.
You cut me off. And coming back to our show for the second time, she represents Illinois' 13th Congressional District.
Nikki Budzinski. It's great to be with you, Jason, and Will.
Yeah, it's good to see you back in studio. Just remind our listeners the contours of your district, because it is one of the more creatively drawn congressional districts in the nation.
It is a long district, yes. So it goes as far south as East St. Louis. So I represent the majority of the communities in both Madison and St. Clair counties. But then it weaves all the way through Springfield, which is where I live. And then it goes all the way over almost to the Indiana border. It includes Urbana-Champaign, the University of Illinois, which is my alma mater and a place I'm very honored to represent.
So you have been in Congress for about 2 years. You're running for re-election. The 2023-2024 session of the House has been interesting. I'm reading a book
That's
now.
Diplomatic, Jason.
I'm reading a book by Dana Milbrink about the Republican caucus, which seems to have had a lot of struggle sessions over the last 2 years. But what do you think, in this environment of a closely divided Congress, what do you think has been some of your major accomplishments over the last couple of years?
I really appreciate the question, because I really do believe one of the things I'm the most proud of is the fact that D.C. has been very hyper-partisan in my first term in office. Politics has been very tough in this Republican House majority. But I've been able to cut through it. And I really think demonstrate to the communities that I represent some real deliverables. Very proud, obviously, of the amount of federal dollars we've been able to bring home. I mean, one of the things in any downstate community in Illinois is about us getting our fair share. And so really prioritizing that, whether it was funding for infrastructure, we were able to secure three different RAISE grants, two of them at least benefiting the Metro East area, Granite City, and then a really larger RAISE grant, $21 million for the city of Edwardsville. But also, like, critical investments in things like our locks and dams, which are so important to Metro East, but not just, you know, Metro East specifically as a region for economic development, but I serve on the House Agriculture Committee. It's critically important to our farmers that they be able to move their goods to market in a very quick pace, and investing in our locks and dams help us keep that competitive edge when it relates to agriculture. I've been focused on a lot of common sense things that, quite frankly, have brought Republicans and Democrats together to work on. So we've introduced a number of different pieces of legislation as well, whether it's trying to re-jumpstart the Affordable Connectivity Program, recently signed on to bipartisan legislation to take on PBMs to help bring down the cost of prescription drugs in this country. A number of my agriculture and Veterans Affairs bills have really been on a bipartisan basis. So finding the places in this hyper-partisan Washington, D.C. environment that can kind of break through, bring people together, and deliver real results. I think we've been able to do that in my first term.
If voters send you back for another 2 years, what's at the top of your list?
The top of my list, I'd say, is building on some of the critical investments and some of the initiatives that we've been focused on. I know, obviously, you've followed a lot of what we've been doing in Cahokia Heights. Cahokia Heights and what has been a decades-long issue around water infrastructure, specifically stormwater flooding issues into this community, has been one of my top priorities from the very beginning of taking office. I'm really proud of some of the progress that we've been able to make, but this is not a problem that's going to solve itself overnight, and I have a very long-term commitment to making sure we get this finally fully resolved. But some of the things we've done on that initiative alone are getting the EPA to designate a coordinator on the ground. We've had that position filled in the community now for well over 7 to 8 months. What that person has really been able to do is work with local stakeholders for the first time to have collaboration on the ground between local, state, and federal resources to identify what we need to be doing, how we need to be funding to solve for this problem. I'd say the other thing is really more on the eastern side of the district. We won a tech hub designation, which I'm incredibly excited about. I joke with people that I represent Silicon Valley, and I'd love to explain that a little bit. So basically, out of the CHIPS and Science Act, really a transformational piece of legislation that the Biden-Harris administration signed into law, the first time as a country we have really reinvested in American manufacturing. Out of that legislation came the opportunity for communities to apply for tech hub designations. There were almost 600 really great applications all across the country. Our district, my district, was able to come together to win one of 12 successful designations as a tech hub. What that means is we're jump-starting a whole new industry in biomanufacturing and fermentation in central Illinois with a $51 million federal grant. And a lot of people, you know, what is biomanufacturing? It's taking a lot of the agricultural waste that is created through corn and soybean production and repurposing it for things like replacing your tennis shoes, replacing plastics, making yoga pants. I mean, this is a new growing industry that we are creating an opportunity for right here in central Illinois. I see myself in a second term continuing to help elevate that and help that reality be fully realized as a new industry that we believe could be up to a $200 billion new industry.
I want to ask you about Cahokia Heights a little later, but first we wanted to start with some national issues. Mm-hmm. So polls consistently find that the economy is one of the most important that voters face. Of course, inflation has come down. Interest rates are starting to drop as well. But there's been a lot of damage done, if you will. So what things in Congress are you in favor of doing that can help everyday Americans in that regard?
Well, first, I think there are a number of pieces of legislation I've been working on to bring down the costs of goods and services that people are still feeling the pain when they're at their kitchen tables trying to make decisions between paying rent and getting groceries, paying for prescription drugs. I think a couple of things. One is I'm an original co-sponsor of the Pharmacist Fight Back Act. What that is us taking on PBMs. These pharmaceutical benefit managers are really the middleman between pharmaceutical companies and patients. They were established as the middleman to actually help us try to bring down the cost of prescription drugs. But what has really been found out is that they are a part of elevating and raising pharmaceutical prescription drug costs. So what the Pharmacist Fight Back Act would do is actually say, we want you to share 80% of the rebate directly with the patient. We want you to stop discouraging patients from going to the pharmacist of their choice. PBMs are really putting the squeeze on local pharmacies. I have a number of local pharmacists in my district that run mom-and-pop shops on Main Street with a pharmacy. They're getting squeezed out of their business because these PBMs are forcing patients to some of the three larger providers. With less competition, what we realize now is that means increasing pharmaceutical and prescription drug costs. So the Pharmacist Fight Back Act is just one way to get at healthcare affordability, which I think is really important. And I see myself really continuing to lead on that issue in a second term. The second second is, again, a bipartisan piece of legislation to really reboot the Affordable Connectivity Program. This was a really important program during COVID that provided a small amount of subsidy to working families that were just struggling to pay for the high costs, often, of high-speed internet access. We all know, coming out of COVID, how important being connected, whether it is for a student that's learning, whether it's for a worker getting skills training to get into a different job, healthcare, telehealth is also, you have to have high-speed internet access. I really believe it should be more of a public utility. But because of the high costs, some families are having to turn off their connectivity. I know in some of the communities I represent, like East St. Louis, which is 95% reliant on that affordable connectivity program. When it expired in May, we needed to find some solutions to how to get that program going again. And with my Republican friend and colleague, Mike Carey from Columbus, Ohio, we found a way to kind of reboot the program. I'm hoping in the lame duck session, we can actually see some movement in the House. We have Senate leads as well that are moving that legislation. But I point to those two things as just examples of how with the right leadership, we can really try to tackle rising costs, whether it's through healthcare, whether it's high-speed internet access. You know, I'm also, I believe in, as we're going to get into this next Congress, talking about the expiration of the 2017 Trump tax plan. I think we need to be looking at middle-class tax relief, working-class tax relief. That should be our priority in this country. And that's a third leg of the stool that I think when we're talking about affordability and helping people with the cost of their daily, you know, goods and, you know, going to the grocery store, et cetera, that's the way that we can help put money back in their pocket.
On immigration, would you have voted for the bipartisan immigration bill that was negotiated by Republican James Lankford of Oklahoma, Independent Kirsten Sinema of Arizona, and Democrat Chris Murphy of Connecticut?
Yes. Okay. And I honestly believe, Jason, that had that bill reached the House floor, I think a number of my colleagues on both sides of the aisle would have voted for it and it would have passed out of the House. I think an equally important question is, why did that not happen? It did not happen because Speaker Mike Johnson called up Donald Trump, and Donald Trump wanted to use this issue as political fodder going into this November election. And really continue to politicize the issue of immigration in this upcoming election. So not looking for real solutions to solving the problems, just wanting to continue to talk about the problem. I have to be honest, that is exactly why I you know, have really struggles with Washington, D.C., and making sure that we're doing things that are really deliverables. Stop with the talking. Let's get some things done. That legislation in the Senate is just a great example of how we could have really meaningfully addressed immigration reform and weren't able to.
One thing that was in that bill would have increased the number of immigration judges. In Missouri, one of the things that an immigration lawyer said on a recent episode of St. Louis on the Air is there's only three immigration judges in Missouri, and they have a backlog of 40,000 cases, which is why when there are deportation cases, it takes years for a judge to adjudicate them. I'm kind of confused why Congress couldn't pass a standalone bill just on that. That doesn't seem very controversial, yet there seems to be no urgency to get something like that done. Why is that?
I completely agree. And I think that the problem is the crisis that has been existing at the border has sucked all of the political oxygen out of the room. It's something that people like to demagogue on, and it has prevented us from seeing the bigger issue, which is that we have a fundamentally broken immigration system in this country. More judges, more lawyers, that is something that is critically important so that we can create more realistic pathways to citizenship for people that want to get into our country. But because we don't have that pathway, because we don't have those judges, and it's taking decades for people to legally enter this country that want to get here, you are seeing the crisis at the border. I believe the crisis at the border is really the symptom of the larger problem, which is that we can't holistically address our broken immigration system. Hiring more judges is one really critical component to it. Working to reform our asylum system, being able to, which is something that I voted on and supported in the House of Representatives, which is funding more Border Patrol agents, more technology around fentanyl getting into the country. How do we stop that? We can't deal with any one of these issues in a piecemeal approach. This is holistically a part of the broken immigration system we have in our country. And I think I am hopeful with different leadership, we're going to be able to get to addressing that.
Say President Trump gets elected. Do you still support that bipartisan bill addressing the border?
Yes. Oh, definitely. I mean, I think that that bill was a compromise. And I would say even there are those within my own party that would argue that in some ways it was a little too punitive or too tough at the border. I would have supported it. I think that there is something more we need to be doing to secure our border. I have been critical of the administration for being what I believe is a little too slow to move on seeing the problems at the border and how people are feeling and seeing it at home. I think we could have seen quicker action. But I think that's exactly what this bipartisan compromise bill coming out, what was negotiated in the Senate, is I think it would have meaningfully more addressed some of these pain points and gotten us more on this path to a more holistic approach to how we fix this broken system.
Next topic is abortion. And this may not happen just given the filibuster still exists and getting 60 votes is tough to do. But in a hypothetical world, would you support legislation to codify the right to an abortion, or is that a state's issue?
Absolutely. I would vote to codify it. I mean, I believe fundamentally that a woman should have the freedom to make her own decisions about her own body. I do not believe that a politician in Washington, D.C. or in a state capitol should be making that decision on her behalf, or certainly be in the doctor's room with her when she's making that very, very personal decision. I think there were a lot of people that never believed that Roe versus Wade was going to be overturned. That day has come, and we are dealing with the after effects of that. As you know, Illinois is a safe haven state. We're very proud to be able to offer women refuge that are seeking reproductive health care. I have a number of those clinics even within my district that when the state of Missouri immediately outlawed abortion in a very draconian way. There were women that were coming in from out of state from Missouri that we were able to offer refuge to. And so I think it's really important. I think that's one of the most important elections of this November.
I asked your opponent, and it's probably only fair to ask you, when maybe you start debating a bill like that, if that ever happens, is there a week limit or are there exceptions that you want? Is it, you know, fetal viability, 15 weeks, whatever it may be? Where do you kind of fall on that spectrum?
Where I would say I fall is that that's a decision for the woman and her doctor. I'm a politician. I can't answer that question on her behalf. I think that is a right of privacy. I think that is a very deeply personal matter. And I leave that to her and her doctor to make that decision.
Wanted to talk unions. You, are, of course, came from unions prior to getting into politics. The Teamsters notably did not endorse Kamala Harris this cycle. The rank and file actually preferred President Trump. The International Association of Firefighters, who you worked for them, they also did not endorse Kamala Harris. They had endorsed Biden in 2020. So I guess maybe the trend is Democrats are losing the working people's vote or rank and file members, union, right? Is that concerning? And what do you do as a Democrat to get those people back?
Well, look, I would say I have a lot of respect. I have a great relationship with the Teamsters. And also, obviously, I worked for 3 years for the International Association of Firefighters. But the labor movement is not monolithic. You know, there are a lot of different unions within the labor movement, and she's overwhelmingly won the vast majority, including the endorsement of the AFL-CIO, which is the umbrella organization that represents the majority of all of the labor movement. So I would actually argue I do believe she has a lot of support from working men and women and the labor movement specifically. On the Teamsters, I mean, I'm very proud that Illinois District Council 25 actually broke with the international and told me this was a very easy decision for them, and they endorsed Vice President Harris. So, you know, I think the importance of this is that reaching working class voters, reaching working men and women is critically important to any successful campaign and to being a good elected official. I mean, those were the folks that I wanted to go and specifically represent in Washington, D.C., and understanding the pain points of, you know, making sure that the collective bargaining process is something that is still vibrant and strong in this country. People have the right to organize for better wages and benefits and safe working conditions. I always stand on the side of working families on those issues, and I believe the Vice President and Governor Walz does as well. But we have to get out there and make that case. That's what I try to do in my own race, talking about job creation, talking about workforce development, the values of union apprenticeship programs. So I think they're doing the work, and I think that's what they have to continue to keep doing until our November 5th election, and then once they're elected, afterwards, because this is a relationship. It is about showing up, and again, it's about deliverables for working people, and I think they'll be able to do that.
You mentioned at the top of the show about the divisions within the Republican caucus. Mm-hmm. One area where I think Democrats in the House have not been on the same page is providing military aid to Israel. Mm-hmm. We're recording this now on October 8th, 2024, when Israel has launched some attacks in Lebanon. There has been elements within your caucus, as I mentioned, that want to do a complete arms embargo on Israel. Mm-hmm. I would believe Missouri Congresswoman Cori Bush is one of those people. Mm-hmm. Where do you kind of fall on that continuum?
Well, look, I think that Israel has been and is our longest standing ally and a democracy within the Middle East region. I think, first of all, a day after the 1 year anniversary of the October 7th attack, obviously we've seen an escalation in the region. But on October 7th, we cannot have, you know, not forget what happened that really instigated where we are today in the region, which was a terrorist organization, Hamas, coming into Israel, savagely murdering Israelis, taking hostage over 200 people, many of them Americans. And so, you know, supporting the right of Israel to defend itself is something that I will always continue to do. I think in recent news, you mentioned some of the, you know, strikes that Israel has made into Lebanon. I'd also point out that Iran has also lodged 180 ballistic missiles at Israel. And because of the funding that we've been able to provide to the Iron Dome for Israel to defend itself, they were able to do that. So I think that this is a continuing, you know, obviously this is a situation that is not going away. I myself pray for de-escalation in the region. I think that the administration has been working diplomatic channels to try to do that. I would like to see us reach a mutual ceasefire in the region where we can have all of the hostages that are still being held in Gaza released and provide critical humanitarian aid to Gaza. I think we have to do multiple things in this region. It's not a either or, it's an and. And, you know, unfortunately, what we're seeing is more escalation in these recent, these most recent months. And I sadly don't see that immediately changing. So I think this is going to be a continuing conversation. And I do meet with constituents on all sides of this issue. And I think that's important to hear people out as the situation continues to evolve.
The future of U.S. Steel and Granite City work specifically here in the Metro East remains unclear. President Biden, former President Trump, and Vice President Harris have all said they would block the nearly $15 billion deal for U.S. Steel to be sold to the Japanese company Nippon. If you are in their shoes, do you block that deal?
Yeah, right now I would block that deal. I mean, I don't think that I have the one thing I have asked as we have talked to Nippon, and we continue to obviously talk to the United Steelworkers and U.S. Steel, is I want to see a commitment to continue investment in Granite City. I'm never going to stop fighting for Granite City and for the steelworkers, the working people of that community. And what that means is I need assurances to see that Nippon is going to see a future for Granite City and continued investment. You know, one of the things I did, even before the Nippon potential sale came on the scene, was to outline for U.S. Steel specific federal grants that they could be taking advantage of. to create different opportunities for steelmaking in Granite City that could potentially keep them investing in Granite City. They've turned down those opportunities, those federal grant opportunities. And so we continue to look for opportunities to point out why the unique steelmaking that we do in Granite City should continue to be happening. We should keep those blast furnaces running. We should continue to make sure that we're protecting the working people in that community. I'm going to continue to advocate for that, and I can't support a deal with Nippon that doesn't see a future for Granite City.
What would you say to those who would argue it's not in the government's best interest to meddle in private business dealings? And also, Japan is maybe as good of an ally as you're going to get for the U.S.
Well, I think it's looking at a couple of things. I think some of it is looking at the consolidation of the industry. That is something that is of concern to me. I also think there are national security concerns. Even though Japan is an ally, it's a foreign country coming in to purchase what could be the overwhelming domestic manufacturing of steel in this country. And so I think those are very valid questions that require investigation and time to look at and analysis. And so I think that's the due diligence that the administration is really doing. And in the meantime, what I'm doing is looking at that, but also making sure that I'm being the best advocate I can for my constituents in Granite City and seeing a future for them in steelmaking.
And a few towns south of Granite City is Cokia Heights, which you mentioned at the top. And I wanted to ask you, and you're probably tired of this question because I feel like I ask you and Dick Durbin and the mayor of Cokia Heights about it. And a lot has been done in terms of getting grants, getting funding going. But and I know you spoke to many of the residents in that area, and they kind of feel like, hey, we see all these things happening, but we still have those same problems. Is there anything more that can be done to speed up relief for many of those residents that have long dealt with all those issues?
What I wish for the community is there would be, an immediate tomorrow fix for everyone, because it is a situation that people have been honestly dealing with for far too long. But what I think my message would be to the constituents is we're coming, we're there, we're making an impact, we're making the investments. These investments are going to take some time, but I am never going to let up on making sure that we finally resolve these issues. And I would highlight a couple of things. One, yes, I talked about the fact that we've been able to get an EPA coordinator on the ground. I think that's added additional transparency, accountability, and collaboration on the ground on these issues at all levels of government that hasn't previously existed. We are working very closely with the Army Corps of Engineers to address a couple of things. I think one is the Spring Lake Project. The Spring Lake Project is something that's going to be critical and I think transformational potentially to really resolving. The ditches in Cahokia Heights and surrounding areas are what overflows with the stormwater issues. If we were able to adequately address the size and expand the size of Spring Lake, Spring Lake would be able to take in much more of that storm water, relieving the pressure on those ditches. That is a top priority of mine that we are working hand in glove with the Army Corps of Engineers to really make progress on. The other thing that we're really working on is to get a study, a reevaluation of the impact on the community and what this decades-long problem of stormwater flooding has meant to the community. That analysis that was done the last time is over 20 years old. So one of the things we're working with both senators on is to get that reevaluation of impact on the community completed. So we have a really clearer picture of what all of this has meant. We can see it every day when I go into the communities and I talk to the residents. It is undeniable the impact of these issues on them in their everyday lives. But I think getting a bigger picture, holistic view of the impact from an economic perspective, from a public health perspective, I think is really important to fully address those issues. So I guess I'd highlight those two things. And we have the EPA coordinator on the ground. We're going to continue this work. And this is, as I said, something that is going to be a top priority of mine going into my second term.
So, and Will can correct me if I'm wrong. In 2022, I think your first election was a pretty closely watched race nationally. Mm-hmm. I think national groups got involved. There was a lot of money. Doesn't seem to be the case, Will, this time around. Your opponent has raised, what, Has he even raised $10,000?
$26,000.
So, but it's not, this district is not like a 50-plus Democratic district. It's still somewhat competitive. So
in theory, it could be a swing district.
It is,
So how are you kind of approaching this strange situation where you have an opponent who hasn't really raised enough money to be competitive, but you're in a district that could be competitive under certain circumstances?
You just don't take anything for granted. I mean, and I won't. I mean, we're working really hard throughout the district to tell the story of the work that we've been doing in this first term and making the case for the work that I want to continue to be doing. And I think that this is a district that is very results-driven. They want to know that I went to Washington in my first term and I made good on my progress, on my my word, which was basically that I'd go and be a workhorse, not a show horse. I wasn't going to be a part of the political noise. I was going to find people to work with. You know, I'm really proud. This is, I think, a typically bipartisan district. It's a district that historically has shifted. You know, Congressman Costello represented parts of this district. Congressman Shimkus, Congressman Rodney Davis. It is really, to your point about it being a swing district, I very much think that it is. And so the work that I've been able to do that's bipartisan, I think, really resonates in this district. And I think just the deliverables, the real results that I can point to of things that I think have had an impact on the communities. That's why I feel like not taking anything for granted, feeling optimistic about November and just making my case as to why I'm hoping to earn a second term in office.
Well, Congresswoman, thank you so much for coming back. And if you win, you can come back again during a non-election year and talk about issues.
I'd love to.
Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. You can read all of our stories on the 2024 election at stlpr.org. And Congresswoman, how could people find out more about your campaign on the World Wide Web?
Oh, just www.nikki, N-I-K-K-I, for congress.com.
Thank you very much. And until next time, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.